This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Jet Setter Show, where we explore lifestyle-friendly destinations worldwide. Enjoy and learn from a variety of experts on topics ranging from upscale travel at wholesale prices to retiring overseas, to global real estate and business opportunities, to tax havens and expatriate opportunities. You'll get great ideas on unique cultures, causes, and cruise vacations. Whether you're wealthy or just want to live a wealthy lifestyle, the Jet Setter Show is for you. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome John Warlow to the show. I really enjoyed his books a few months ago. They are Built to Sell, Creating a Business That Can Thrive Without You, and The Automatic Customer, Creating a Subscription Business in Any Industry. John, welcome. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Jason. Good to be with you.
Good to have you, and you're coming to us from chilly Toronto, is that correct?
That's right.
Not as chilly as it is sometimes, though.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah,
that's
good stuff. Good stuff. Tell us about how you got into helping businesses increase their value.
So I used to own a company which I went to sell and was told it was worthless. This goes back about 15 years ago. It was a consulting company. It was based largely on, you know, my own work to drum up customers. We built it up to $4 or $5 million in revenue. So, and we had clients like Microsoft and IBM. I mean, we had really good blue chip clients. So I thought I was sitting on this little gold mine.
Right.
And I went to see a guy named Perry Miele, I'll never forget. And gave him a few, you know, details on the company, and he said, "Yeah, it's totally worthless." And for it's been like told your baby's ugly. It was devastating for me at the time, but it kicked off this kind of long term journey to figure out, okay, well, what does drive the value of a company?
So why was it worthless, though? I mean, you know, a consulting company with blue chip clients. I mean, that wasn't all about you. Was it built around your personal brand, or why did he say it was worthless?
Yeah. So at the time we had too much customer concentration. So we had two or three major clients that were generating a ton of our revenue. Those relationships resided with me personally. So I was the one kind of doing the selling. I was still involved in overseeing a lot of the work that we did. So I was way too deeply entwined with the company. Now, to be clear, could have sold that company in its old structure, but it would have been on an earnout. So an earnout is where you essentially accept little or no money for your company up front, right, and then you get paid over time. But the risk is all on your shoulders, none on the buyer. And it's the entrepreneur's enemy, right? Like, you never want to have the majority of your proceeds from the sale of your company stuck in an earnout, because you don't control the outcome of an earnout.
Yeah. Okay. Good stuff. What did you do next? And talk to us about the general philosophy of building value, or more specifically about subscription revenue value, whichever you like.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back now, keep in mind, this goes back probably 15 years ago, if not more. And at the time, you might recall that companies like Forrester, Gartner, Jupiter, Yankee, to some extent Thomson Reuters, were all coming out with subscription offerings. These were essentially research offerings wherein you paid a fee to get access to some unique information from those companies. And they went out and sold the same information to multiple companies. And so that was the model we adopted. And we went from, you know, having a few clients to having hundreds of clients, all of which were Fortune 500 companies that paid us on a subscription basis, which ultimately was acquired by what became Gartner Group, big publicly traded Fortune 500 company. And it never would have been a sellable asset had we not moved from one-time transactions to a subscription model. So there are a couple of pieces there. One is making sure your company has a recurring revenue model that is not dependent on you personally. And number two, that you've got some good customer diversification. So we went from, again, having two or three clients at any one time to having hundreds. Those two factors probably played the biggest role in making it a sellable asset.
Okay, good. So what should entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs listening to this, what should they do? How should they think? What action should they take?
I'm going to say something. It sounds really easy to say, and it's incredibly difficult to do. But
a lot of things in life are like that.
Yes, it's the killer app. you know, the essence of building a valuable company is ensuring that your company can thrive without you personally. And again, that sounds incredibly easy to do, but for most small businesses, especially ones in the information space, they're deeply dependent on the owner. And so the trick, I think, the first step in this process, Jason, is to figure out, you know, something that meets the trifecta of scale. So this is something that you offer today that meets three attributes. It's got to be teachable to employees, valuable to customers, and repeatable, meaning customers have to purchase it on some sort of regular cadence. And so that's really the first step in getting your business to go from one that is deeply dependent on you to one that has the potential to scale. Said another way, it's like for a lot of small businesses, they start off selling lots of things to a few people. That's the definition of most small businesses, right? They're selling lots of different products and services to a few people. And the most valuable companies do exactly the opposite. They sell just a few things to lots of people. And again, making that transition is about figuring out your trifecta of scale, what's teachable, what's valuable, what's repeatable.
Okay. So essentially have a large diversified customer base. Is that the takeaway?
Yes, but it's more than that. It's having a large group of customers that is only buying one or two things from you. Because for you to get your business to not be dependent on you personally, it comes down to, can you train employees to do it? And employees thrive on repetition, whereas entrepreneurs thrive on diversity, right? Like as most entrepreneurs, we love the new thing, right? The shiny ball, what's exciting, what's new. And that means that we tend to not finish things well. We tend to be better at starting things. Employees are exactly the opposite, right? There's a reason they're employees. There's a reason they haven't started their own company. And that is because they want to do things in a replicatable way. And so that's a conflict point for a lot of business owners because we want to do what's new. Employees thrive on what's consistent and what's stable. Okay. And so that's where we have to sort of temper our entrepreneurial instincts and give employees the ability to kind of get really good at doing one or two things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So take us through doing that. I mean, you know, like you say, it's easier said than done, right? What does someone do if they've got a lot of people really are very much interested in info-oriented businesses because they have a lot of scale to them. You know, it's a one-to-many model. It's very portable. You can live the quote-unquote laptop lifestyle. Everybody's attracted to all this stuff, right? But what do they do to actually do that, you know, especially in a position where maybe they're the center of attention, it's personal brand based. Any advice for those people?
Well, first of all, those businesses generally aren't sellable. Mm-hmm. So what you've got to do is transfer the brand equity from you to a thing. And so it's become very popular to talk about your personal brand, your social media footprint, and all those things are tremendous for selling information products. And at the same time, they dilute and in fact make your company worthless. And so what you've got to do is convert personal brand equity into company brand equity. If your website is a picture of you and a shining face sitting on an Audi A8, that's a problem. That says that you're successful, but it doesn't say you have a company. It says you have a cult of personality. It says you have a thing.
Yeah.
And so what you need to do is some of the basics, right? Like name your company. Don't have your face on your website. Mm-hmm. Have a thing that you're offering and not a personal product. That's a big departure for a lot of information people who are, quote unquote, living the laptop lifestyle, selling their information product, but not building a company, if that makes sense.
So you see, the problem is that's like a decision the entrepreneur needs to make because the personal brand is a great sales tool. Yeah. Now, interestingly, and you don't know this, but I wrote my first book back in 1999, and it is on the New York Times worst seller list. and it's called Become the Brand of Choice. And I just seem to have discovered the personal brand thing very early in the game. I'd say it really started with Lee Iacocca. That was kind of the first sort of corporate personal brand way back in the 80s. And, you know, I latched onto that in my early career when nobody even, that wasn't even a phrase. Nobody ever said that, you know. And I mean, it's not like I was the only one. I know other people were doing it too. But, you know, one of the things I said, John, is I said that people don't have relationships with companies, logos, buildings, mission statements. They have relationships with people. And that's the thing. It's like a hard decision for a lot of people to make to go from the personal brand, which is sort of, it's a sales tool. It's sort of easier to market a person than it is a company brand, right? You know, for a small business, right? It's different in the big Fortune 1000 world, obviously. But they maybe have to give something up to get something in the long term, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where, again, most of us as founders use our profit and loss statement as our report card. And while that can be a good way to measure how you did from one year to the next, it can also be very deceptive because making profit and lining your pockets with money is great from one year to the next. But if that's your goal, it can actually tremendously undermine the value of your business. So, for example, if you're out there generating a lot of personal brand equity and you're doing speeches and you're doing books and you're doing all these things that are generating income, that's great, but it's not necessarily transferable value. So it comes down to how do we create an asset that is not dependent on us. It starts with figuring out what your TBR is, what product you have that could be delivered without your personal creativity, your personal delivery model. Take a really, really, you know, famous example, Gary Vaynerchuk as an example, tremendous best-selling author, wants to buy the New York Jets one day, just a, you know, a huge successful author and an amazing entrepreneur in many levels. He's created VaynerMedia. VaynerMedia being an advertising agency and digital marketing company.
But it's very much built around him.
Very tough to sell that company.
But it still has value. I mean, to be fair, these personal brand-oriented companies do sell. Okay?
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do, but they do so on an earnout. Mm-hmm. And again, an earnout, the way a VaynerMedia-type company would be acquired would be they would be acquired by one of the large advertising agency holding companies. And they do deals, which is basically a 70-30 split. You know, they'll say, Gary, we'll buy your company for, let me throw out a number, $100 million. We're going to give you $30 million up front, and $70 million will be in a 5 or 7 year earnout, where you've got to make that money over time.
But just on balance, though, and you know, we'll get off of this topic after this comment. It'll be the last comment on this. But even companies that aren't personally branded sell on earnouts too, right?
Yeah, the proportion would be much different.
Yeah,
it would be more like 80% up front, 20% on the earnout, that kind of thing.
Okay, good, good. So what can people do, you know, specifically like the actual things they do, right, to build value, to increase the value of their companies? You have this whole kind of coaching program. You have a whole bunch of coaches that do this. What do they take people through? This is sort of after you read the book, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So growth potential is going to be huge, right? So for a lot of entrepreneurs, we think about riding it over to the maximum point where it's maximum value and then selling it at the perfect time when we've sort of squeezed every ounce of juice out of the lemon. And that's the wrong way to think about it. The right way to think about it is saying you want to sell much earlier in the game. I'll give you an example. Rod Drury, who started Xero, the accounting SaaS-based, cloud-based accounting platform.
The QuickBooks competitor, sure.
Yeah, yeah. He started a company called Aftermail to fund the creation of Xero. And he developed a new way for people to archive their email. This was in the time of Sarbanes-Oxley and so forth. He sold it to two Fortune 500 companies, each $1 million license to each two of these, you know, Fortune 500 companies. And for a lot of entrepreneurs with that degree of success, you went to charter, you know, very prestigious companies. They would say, great, put the pedal to the metal. Let's go sell to the other 498. Drury, to his credit, did something different. He went to a systems integrator who already had the other 498 as customers and said, why don't you buy the company? He sold Aftermail, which at the time was generating $2 million of revenue, for $35 million. That's an unbelievable multiple of revenue, but he did it because of its growth potential, because the systems integrator could see how big it could be so quickly. Okay. If he had gone out and harvested all that revenue himself, he never would have sold it for such a high multiple.
Okay, so tell us a little more about harvesting versus having the big growth potential.
Yeah, it's really leaving some field left to plow, to use a farming analogy. Like, I'll give you the opposite. So Roger is a great example. There's the opposite. I've got a friend who has a radiation treatment cleanup business. He helps people deal with their radioactive waste. So hospitals and so forth have radioactive waste in their X-ray machines, and he helps companies clean that up. He is sanctioned or authorized as one of only two radiation cleanup companies to do what he does in Canada by the Canadian Radiation Safety Board. He's got like 95% market share of every hospital, airport in the country. And so he's got the opposite problem in the sense that there's very little field left to plow for an acquirer to come in. Private equity group might buy his business because it just churns out profits reliably year after year. But it would be difficult to make the case it's going to grow very, very quickly because he's already got maximum market share. So most people think, market share is a good thing. And to some extent it is. It gives you pricing authority. But too much market share can be a bad thing from an acquirer's perspective.
And that's an interesting way to look at it, but I see your point. Okay, good. What else?
Yeah, so recurring revenue is going to be the secret sauce, right? Especially recurring revenue that doesn't rely on you personally. So to give you a sense of how big recurring revenue can be in terms of valuation, take a look at security companies. So Jason, you've seen probably come buy from one, right? Security companies that to secure your home or your office.
Yeah, and they charge you $30 a month and they get on the contracts. Yeah.
Yeah, the $30 a month is called their monitoring revenue. Right. And then for a lot of security companies, they also have installation revenue, the one-time revenue.
Right. But it's not much. It's $100,
Yeah, the installation's pretty cheap. It's a bit more in a commercial setting, if it's a commercial job. But you're right, in residential, it's very little.
So how much, I know what you're getting at there, and feel free to elaborate more, but I want to make sure. How much should a business be willing to, lose on that customer acquisition for that MRR, monthly recurring revenue? I've had many alarms installed in my homes over the years. The guys here all day, they charge me $100. They put in three panels, a couple of motion sensors, a siren. Just those materials alone cost way more than $100. And then the labor of the guy being here for a full day running wires around, doing all kinds of stuff, they got to be losing a fortune on the install to get my $29 a month contract for 2 years, right?
They sure are, but it's worth it to them because the lifetime value far exceeds the customer acquisition cost. So for anybody in the recurring revenue game, whether you're selling information products or software, the most important statistic to monitor is this thing called LTV to CAC. LTV stands for lifetime value of a customer, and CAC stands for customer acquisition costs. Okay. And most investors, professional money people, venture capitalists and so forth, institutional money, are looking for subscription-based companies with an LTV to CAC of at least 3-to-1, meaning for every dollar you spend to acquire the customer, and that would include any costs you subsidize in the installation, for every dollar you spend to acquire the customer, you're capturing at least $3 of lifetime value. So for round numbers, let's say you're paying $30 a month and you stick with your security company for 60 months, 5 years, let's say. Yeah. 30 times 60 is $1,800, I think, if I'm doing the math right on the back of my head. Yep. So that's your LTV, your lifetime value of that customer before they churn out. So that would mean that if $1,800 is your lifetime value, you would have to win that customer for less than $600 to be on target for that, at least a 3-to-1 LTV to CAC ratio.
And then you really have to do an even more complicated calculation than that if you're really looking into the lifetime value of money or time value of money, I should say, if it's a long-term lifetime value. But forget about that. The simple example is good enough. Here's the thing though, John, a lot of these, in fact, I think the vast, vast majority of SaaS-based software products all over the web, we all subscribe to them all, many of them, they basically say cancel at any time. They'll say, well, you get a discount if you pay for the year, right? So I guess they do have a lifetime value of at least a year, right, for a web-based software product. But, you know, some will just say month-to-month, cancel anytime, right? And they'll spend money to acquire that customer. How do you make that calculation?
Well, first of all, business-to-business subscription companies rarely have a cancel anytime policy. Most business-to-business software from, you know, Zuora to Oracle to Salesforce.com have contract terms, and they get – so that is how they estimate the value of the contract. Essentially, what you're doing to calculate in a business-to-consumer model where you give the customer the opportunity to cancel at any time, you're essentially calculating something called your MRR churn rate. So MRR stands for monthly recurring revenue. And your churn rate is usually expressed as a revenue number. So let's imagine for round numbers, let's imagine you have $100 of MRR coming into your company at the beginning of a month. Let's say you have 10 subscribers paying you $10 each. Your MRR would be $100. Further, let's imagine you lose one of those customers. Essentially, they cancel. So now your MRR churn rate is 10%, $10. You lose $10 of the $100 you had coming into the month. And so that's a key statistic enabling you to identify your LTV to CAC ratio, because your LTV in a business to consumer model is calculated by taking your MRR divided by your MRR churn rate. Mm-hmm. All this stuff, there's a lot of math that's kind of hard to listen to.
Yeah, right. It sort of needs to be demonstrated visually.
Yeah, it's in the book, and there's some examples in Automatic Customer. That's probably the better place to get some of the kind of nitty-gritty. But essentially, the principles are you're calculating your lifetime value based on how much revenue you capture from a typical customer and your typical churn rate. So you can predict, essentially, in that business-to-consumer example you referenced, what your churn rate is going to be, and therefore your lifetime value of a typical subscriber.
Okay, so we got to wrap up here fairly soon, but in the book, the Automatic Customer book, in part two, you talk about the 9 subscription business models. I want to run through those. You grab comments on whatever you want, whichever one, right? The membership website model, that's what I was just referring to. The all-you-can-eat library model, the private club model, the front of the line model, the consumables model, the surprise box model, the simplifier model, the network model, the peace of mind model. What do you want us to know about that?
Basically, I want you to know that no matter what industry you're in, you can create recurring revenue. There's a good example in the book from the guys who started H. Bloom. They're a flower store who decided to sell flowers on subscription. So they went out to hotels and restaurants who buy flowers regularly to give that kind of prestigious image and said, look, don't bother walking down to the local flower store. We'll sell you flowers on subscription. And it's an example of an industry where you wouldn't intuitively think subscription revenue would be possible, but they've done it. And so the goal of the Automatic Customer is not to regurgitate a bunch of SaaS models, because we all know SaaS companies, software as a service models, bill on subscription. The goal for the book was to say, no matter what industry you're in, whether you're selling dog food or flowers or information products, you can create recurring revenue. And it's going to be probably the single most important attribute making your company valuable is going to be the recurring revenue model you've created.
Okay, good. What else do you want people to know? Just anything I haven't asked you about either book or any of your work, John?
Let me circle back on the security company example. The installation revenue, by the way, is worth about 75 cents on the dollar. The recurring revenue to an acquirer is worth about $2 for every dollar of revenue. So your recurring revenue, in the case of security businesses, is worth roughly dollar for dollar about 3 times more than the installation revenue. Just to sort of finish that point from earlier, and this is kind of one major driver, recurring revenue, in making a company more valuable. There's 8 factors we measure, but that's probably, you know, arguably the most important of the 8.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. Okay, give out your website.
ValueBuilder.com.
ValueBuilder.com. Just a final question for you. What is the future of any of this? You know, what are some of the best sort of future-proofing tips? Where do you think all of this is going? I mean, it's like, you know, in my businesses, we just live in a subscription society nowadays. And I try to keep remembering what it was like when we used to go buy Microsoft Office for $350 bucks and then we'd own it. But then Bill Gates would always make so many flaws in it that we'd have to upgrade it anyway. So that was really a subscription in disguise, you know. But
Oh, you're a skeptic.
Yeah, I'm a skeptic. Cynical guy. But, you know, I mean, it just feels like we're just getting soaked by subscription fees everywhere, and managing the subscriptions is such a hassle. So that's a consumer side. But from a business owner side, you know, what anything coming down the pike, anything we should sort of be mindful of or know about for the future?
Yeah, the Amazonification of everything. I mean, Amazon, the Everything Store, is all in on subscriptions, right? So Amazon Prime, we all subscribe to. Amazon Mom, they bought diapers.com because they wanted to get in the business of auto shipping diapers. They do groceries. They've got Amazon Web Services for B2B model. I mean, they are – the reason Amazon is a $1 trillion company is not because we buy books and stuff on Amazon. It's because of the subscription revenue they've created. And what that means for small businesses is being the local guy or gal has basically become moot, right? Just because you're the local dog food provider means nothing anymore. Mm-hmm. So my sense of where we're going is more subscriptions and more – we've got to rethink our competitive point of differentiation in a world of subscriptions. The other thing I would say is that it's awfully tempting to let inertia take hold and say, you know, the classic would be when you ask a small business owner, when do you plan to sell? The classic is, well, you know, probably the next 3 to 5 years. You go back to the same business owner 5 years later, said, hey, did you sell that company? And they say, no, you know, we're probably 3 to 5 years away from selling it. They're permanently 3 to 5 years away from selling. And that's dangerous because industries change at an incredible pace. The S&P 500, I read a statistic recently in the 50s, a typical S&P company would stay on that list for 60 years. Today, it's 20. Uh-huh. Companies are growing in terms of value very quickly and then becoming irrelevant equally quickly. And so my message to business owners is, hey, if you've built a valuable company, you know, don't be greedy. Sell it. you know, put some money in your jeans, create some value, go do the next thing, because you never know when the world will change.
Yeah, it is a fast-changing world. There's no question about that. Well, very interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us, and keep up the good work.
Well, thanks, Jason. It's good to be with you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.